The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by, I suppose, 80s royalty, Mark Almond. Originally Soft Cell was where he would have shot to fame, then all of his own solo career. He has spent some time living around the world. His latest album is just out. He has released that back in July. It's called I'm Not Anyone. He is touring it. He's going to be in the Olympia Theatre on Thursday, the 26th of September, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Are you looking forward to playing Dublin? Are they a decent crowd?
I always look forward to coming to Dublin. One of my favourite cities. I love it. And of course, the theatre, the Olympia, I think it's a lovely theatre. I think I may have played there once before, many, many years ago. I did something with a lovely lady called Agnes Burnell, who was a singer who sadly no longer with us, was based in Dublin. So I think I know the theatre, and I think it's a really lovely one.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's very intimate. Everybody sits the from the gods all the way down. They're nice and close to you. It feels like a much smaller room than it actually is. The Agnes Burnell thing is interesting, though. How many, not so much how many, of all of the people that you did duets with and collaborations with, because there have been many, who was the most significant? Who did you enjoy the most?
Well, they've all been kind of different, you know. So it's all, whenever you kind of do a duet with someone, it's a different thing. Sometimes it's kind of, sometimes you don't even do it together because you're in different places at different times and you record your vocal parts at different times. Sometimes you come together and you work together. I mean, they've all been quite interesting. I mean, of course, it was very interesting working with Gene Pitney, even though we did our original vocal at separate times. Also working with Nico was quite interesting, Susie Sue, you know, a lot of my favorite people I've had a chance to work with, you know, and Bronski Beat, Jimmy Somerville, fantastic. I've got a chance to work with do some duets with some really kind of different and interesting people, and they're all quite, and it's all been very interesting to do. I've kind of gone off a bit duets, to be quite honest, because whenever you do a duet, it always turns out to be, this is the song that's going to be the single, this single from the album. But also the other artist has their own plans and their own things they want to do. So it never really works out like that. I did a wonderful track with Beth Ditto of The Gossip a few years ago on the Velvet Trail album. And it just screamed, let's release this as a single. But Beth was doing her own album, doing her own thing. So it was a bit of a shame that the opportunity didn't happen, but it's always exciting to work with different people.
It's a cool set to be in as well, because if I remember right, wasn't Nico at one point managed by Andy Warhol?
I think she was very in the early days, because Andy Warhol managed the Velvet Underground when Nico was part of the Velvet Underground in the very, very way back in the 60s. But I'd always really sort of thought she was fascinating person, and really we had a really strange and interesting day together playing pool actually a lot of the day, so which is, you know, anything but do the vocal, so you know, it's great. I'm always glad when you get to work with a musical legend or musical icon, because you find that they elevate you to a different place, and you know, so it's always exciting to do that.
Is it ever intimidating?
It's intimidating as well, yeah. I mean, of course, I was intimidated a little bit by meeting Gene, but Gene Pitney. We met for the first time doing that record in what was a neon scrapyard, a neon junkyard in Las Vegas, and they'd lit up all these broken old neons and things that they'd taken from the casinos and things. I've seen it used in films since. And the first time we ever met, they'd built a stage for us and the camera was rolling, and we walked from either side of the stage, and I was wearing a black tuxedo. Gene was wearing a white, which he hated, I should say, and I feel very bad for that now. And so when we met together for the first time on the stage in this neon junkyard in Las Vegas and sang the song together for the video, but he was such a lovely, warm, professional person. That I was, as usual, a bit of a drama queen as ever. So basically, he was a great person to learn total calm and professionalism from. And he made everything easy when we did some promotion stuff together. So it was great.
Talk to me a little about your innate drama queenness, because I assume when you were in Soft Cell, the industry that was wrapped around you and the money that was involved, there must have been a lot of people telling you to quiet your inner drama queen.
Atomic. Probably may have not really put it, but I mean, but it's probably not the best way of putting it. But I think the thing is, I mean, Dave and I, when we first started Soft Cell, we'd just done 5 years at art college. We were art students. We were very belligerent art students. We'd grown up through the time of punk, you know, we'd come up through the time of punk. That's when we started. We were kind of a post-punk band, really. So we were really kind of against all that corporateness. And then we're suddenly thrust into this very commercial corporate world of commercial pop music. And everything, you know, I wanted to do what I wanted to express myself, how I wanted to. Dave was always the quiet one to do anything. He was happy to do anything. He was always kind of laughing in the background at all the kind of drama that was being caused. But the record company always say, tone it down, you know, don't put that on, don't put that on, don't do that. Don't move about like that. And so I just said, you know what? I'll just go on and be myself. I'll wear 10 times more eyeliner. I'll wear more kind of, you know, studded bracelets. And they were going, oh, no, no, no. But whatever it did, it worked, because it was one of the number one record all over the world. You know, it was in America in the Guinness Book of Records. So that look, whatever I had then, and of course, a lot of people hated it. And I'm thank God we didn't have social media in those days, because I can imagine the trolling would have been unbelievable. But enough people liked it and made it a huge hit. And that carried on for quite a few hits that we had. So I think we did the right thing in the end, but we really had to battle against people who really wanted to change it and make it different.
And what about your sexuality? Were you under pressure to keep quiet the fact that you were gay?
It was a very different, yeah. I think the press people in those days, all the time, they try and invent, look, why are you going to this party with this person, this lady? Well, I think when I became friends with Susie the Banshees, I think the press person was straight onto that. Can we get photographs of you together? And can we pretend there's a romance going on? I said, absolutely no. And the ironic thing is, most of the press department were gay, actually. So they wanted to kind of check. So I just said, I as everybody in those days, you were very blurry about it. And you were very, I just said, look, it's obvious, really. You know, you have to say it's kind of absolutely obvious. So I don't really need to say very much, really. But I think there was all that pressure at that time. You know, people, there was a very heavy from the media at that time, from the radio, from TV, from record companies, from the corporate side of things, very, very, a lot of homophobic things. You were working in a very much homophobic industry, I think. So, you know, I think people who were of the early 80s were very kind of blurry about it. Some were kind of even blurry about it much longer than I was. And it was someone like Jim, it took someone like Jimmy Somerville, actually, that came along was the first. I mean, there was, of course, Tom Robinson back in the punk days. But of the early 80s, in the time of, you know, Margaret Thatcher and conservatism, Jimmy Somerville came along and he was just very out there. He presented a very image that he was just a regular guy, young guy and everything. And it changed a lot of things, I think.
Yeah, it's funny because when you were talking about the Agnes Burnell experience of having played in Dublin before, even that, the difference between Ireland and Dublin now in terms of openness and inclusion, I mean, not that it is perfect, but God, it's a radically different place than the 80s.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it is. I mean, I can always feel that whenever I'm there. I mean, I always get great audiences there, you know, really fantastic. I always say whenever I do a tour, I've got to play Dublin. I've got to play Dublin. You know, I like to play, I mean, anywhere in Ireland, but it's just a city that I just really like it. It's a very, very lovely city. And I think, you know, it's much different than it used to be. But the sad thing is, you know, with social media has brought back things like trolling and homophobia as well. So it's kind of, you know, but the main thing is, and I think working in Ireland, one of the best people, the most successful people I've done a duet with was David Gray, of course. And he did a version of Sailor Wave Goodbye, which was just fantastic. And he brought it over to a whole new audience. And I think that was probably one of the best duets, the most successful duet I've done, apart from Gene, with David Gray. And I got to sing it with him a couple of times on stage as well. And I was performing to an audience who weren't my audience, and it went down fantastically. We did Sailor Wave Goodbye, we did Tainted Love together. And only a couple of years ago in Dublin, so I've got to thank David Gray a lot for doing that song, because He also, I got a lot of really, really great royalties as well, because White Ladder was just a massive, massive album. And when David played it a couple of years ago, you know, of course he had to play Sail Away with Goodbye as well. But he really changed that song and he did something very different with it. So I would say that was probably one of the most, probably one of the top duets.
Were you able to give him any advice? Because casting my mind back, David Gray went from relatively small clubs, fairly unknown, to absolutely huge. I mean, White Ladder was a massive, it was defining for a couple of years, which I assume was a similar experience than you had. I mean, your first album was independently released thanks to David Bell's mother coughing up the cash. And it became, I mean, Billboard, as you say, Billboard, what, you had the record for longest Billboard Top 100 in the States on the Guinness Book World Records. That has to be difficult to deal with, that sudden onslaught of fame.
Well, it was very difficult. Honestly, we handled it very, very badly. As I said, we were two very belligerent art students with our own ideas and our own ways. And we weren't really geared up for that kind of success so quick. And I think we very much fought against it. The record company became the enemy, which they weren't really. They were just a record company. They wanted to sell records. That was what record companies do. And they wanted you to sell as many records for you as possible. So, but of course, for us, it was just a constant battle. We had a manager that he was quite a maverick in so many ways. He was very young and not really kind of geared to handle. So with Dave and I and the manager, Steve-O, it was just a very, very chaotic time. So I couldn't give David advice. I mean, he could probably give me more advice, probably. But the thing about that record as well, David Sail Away with Goodbye, I wasn't really aware about it. And I think I was on a radio show in Dublin, quite a few, before White Ladder came out. And somebody played it and they said, "What do you think of this?" And they played me the record. And maybe I'd been asked to do it and it had passed me by somewhere, I don't know. And I was like, wow. I was just so knocked out. Someone had done it and someone had turned it into their own song. And I think a lot of people would probably quite a lot of people would associate that song with David Gray, probably as much as Soft Cell, because that was a massive record.
When you talk about how chaotic it was, would you have changed any of it? Because I imagine when you are, as you describe it, a young art student, when you are in that scene with the sort of the communards and that group, it must have been fun, even if it was mayhem.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of fun, of course. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, the first time we were on TV shows doing Top of the Pops and all that kind of thing. It was amazing experiences for us, you know, because it was not long before that we'd just been art students and then we were on Top of the Pops. So it was a great time, even though it'd been chaotic. Maybe, you know, we could have done things better, we could have been given some better advice on a few things if we'd had maybe an older manager who was more experienced. But you know what Steve-O brought to the table as well was something really good. It was all part of the adventure of it all. You know, and you can't look back and think, well, I could have done that better and I could have done this better, I could have done that better, because it takes you to where you are today. And that was the ride that you were on and that was the adventure that you were on. And that's what it was. And there's no point looking back and saying, we should have done this, we should have done that. And there's a few things that I really wish I'd done, like put one of my own songs on the B-side of Tainted Love, for example, instead of putting another cover version, because I'd probably be a multi-millionaire by now.
Does it make that big a difference if you have your own on the B-side?
Oh, it does, yeah. If you have your own record on the B-side of a record, of a single, if it's a cover version and you do your own song on it, it's the same royalties as having the A-side. So every time it's played, that the B-side is counted as well as a thing. So whatever you make from that record, it's like, you know, I can't imagine how many records Tainted Love has sold, because even now it has a huge life. It's much bigger than me. I mean, the record's far bigger than me. But that's probably a thing I would look back and I kind of cringe a bit about, you know. And then I made the same mistake with Somebody's Got a Hold of My Heart, because I just didn't think it was going to be a hit. You know, I didn't know what it was going to be. You know, then it was another number one, and I made the same mistake twice. So I had some kind of some bad advice, and I should have been a little less naive by the time Somebody's Got a Hold of My Heart came out.
On the topic of Tainted Love, is it a love-hate relationship you have with that single now? Because it was so successful that I assume you can't get away from it. As soon as your name gets mentioned, it comes with you.
You have to embrace it, because the thing is, you know, after I split from Soft Cell, I decided to do no Soft Cell songs for a few years because I wanted to have the kind of challenge of almost starting again from scratch. Of course, you don't, because people know your name, and Top of the Pops that in those days was watched by so many millions that everybody knows your name, whether they like you, hate you, love you, or whatever. So, you know, it's kind of, but then there comes a point where you just have to embrace it. And I know I kind of have a lot of love for it, you know. As I say, it's much bigger than I am. When I hear it on the taxis all the time, hear it on TV and film soundtracks, I'm watching TV shows that I really like. I'm watching the series, and the Tainted Love blasts out, you know, in some fantastic scenes as well. In La La Land, the whole record is played in La La Land, you know, for a pool party, and I'm thinking, well, wow, I didn't even really, you know. And so it was kind of amazing. So you have to learn to love it. And so when you play, that is the reward that you give to everyone when you do a concert, when you do a show. They've listened to the songs that they kind of tolerate, you know, the songs that you want to play and they put up with. And then you give them that at the end, and everyone can go home happy, and you do Sail Away with Goodbye, and everybody's totally, totally happy, and we can leave as fantastic friends.
And Mark is going to be playing Dublin's 3 Olympia Theatre on Thursday, the 26th of September. Mark, great pleasure to talk to you.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.